Good evening and welcome to City Visions, now in its 20th year on KALW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, our topic is Walk Steady, securing safe and walkable San Francisco streets. At some point in everyone's day, most of us are pedestrians, walking this 7x7 swatch of land we know as San Francisco. The city's relatively small size, temperate weather, and inviting neighborhoods makes the city inherently walkable. Yet statistics tell a very different story. San Francisco is one of the most dangerous cities for pedestrians nationwide, with over 800 people hit by cars here each year. That's between 2 and 3 pedestrians a day. In one of his last acts as mayor, Gavin Newsom signed an executive directive setting ambitious goals for reductions in pedestrian injuries and fatalities over the next decade. As a result, multiple city agencies have been tasked with coming up with a unified and coordinated approach to improving pedestrian safety that looks at reengineering our streets, enforcing traffic laws for motorists and pedestrians alike, to gathering data and raising public awareness. And tonight, we've gathered several of those individuals whose job it is to make San Francisco's streets safer for pedestrians. As we ask, what makes a city that appears so walkable so unsafe? Are some neighborhoods more dangerous for pedestrians than others? What measures can be put into place to improve safety and encourage walking? And how are local agencies responding to this issue? Joining me tonight in the studio to discuss these questions and more are Diana Lopez, Prevention Director with the San Francisco Injury Center at UC San Francisco. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you.
And we're also joined here in the studio by Elizabeth Stamp. She's Executive Director of Walk SF, a member-based pedestrian advocacy organization. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're joined by two guests. First, we have Timothy Papandreou, Deputy Director of the SFMTA Sustainable Streets Long Range Planning and Policy Division. Welcome, Timothy.
Hi.
And finally, we're joined by Dr. Rajiv Bhatia. He's Director of Environmental Health with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation in about 20 minutes by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And I'm not sure if one of our phone guests has their radio on because I'm hearing a little bit of an echo here. Not sure. Our engineer is going to work on that. Anyway, 415-841-4134 for your calls or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. All right. So Diana Lopez with the San Francisco Injury Center at UCSF, I wanted to start with you. So tell us a little bit about the statistics that we've talked about. Drill down a little deeper. Tell us who's getting hit out there and in terms of numbers and what's it look like?
Sure. So you've already mentioned some of the statistics, but I also wanted to say at the macro level, what we're looking at is that our rate of pedestrian injury here in San Francisco is about 1.5 times the national average. What that means is about 100 per 100,000 people are getting hit by cars. And if you look at our national public health goals for the number of people that should be getting hit by cars, it's about 5 times that national goal. So here in San Francisco, we do have a much higher rate of pedestrian injury versus, you know, what we're seeing nationally. One of the things that we did here in San Francisco at the Injury Center is we looked at what is the actual economic cost of getting hit by a car. And the reason we wanted to know that is we wanted to begin to make an argument based on the economy, but also just based on, you know, having making a case for prevention. With a lot of illnesses, we tend to, you know, make a social case and talk about the suffering that people experience, but we hardly ever talk about the economic implications. So our study basically looked at all of the pedestrian injuries that occurred in San Francisco, which ended up being about 3,600 that we saw at San Francisco General Hospital.
Over what time span?
Over the time span of 2004 to 2008. And a lot of people ask me, well, how do you know that you got, you know, all of the injuries in your hospital? It turns out that our hospital is the only trauma center for the city of San Francisco. And because all auto versus pedestrian injuries are considered traumas, naturally, if they require an ambulance, which are the very severe ones, they'll tend to get rerouted to us. Or if they, for some reason, are taken to a place like Kaiser and there's no trauma team that can treat them there, they get rerouted again to us.
So you have a great place to start in terms of all the data is collected in one place.
Correct.
So what'd you find?
So what we found was that over that five-year span, the actual cost of injury was about $75 million. And when we say cost, we actually mean cost, not charges, because in healthcare, you know, the charge and the cost is going to be very, very different. Per year average, what ended up being $15 million. So pretty much as the years pass and as we continue seeing the rate of pedestrian injury either steadily increasing or staying pretty constant.
And cost to who here?
And the cost is actually to the public primarily. So we found that about 75%, depending on the year, 75 to 80% of the cost was actually charged to public funds. Mm. And that's Medicare, Medi-Cal, Healthy San Francisco, and patients themselves. And at least one of the patients in the sample actually had to pay $505,000 out of pocket for the injuries that he or she sustained.
Mm.
The other thing we found was that the average cost of just going through the emergency department doors alone was about $6,400. And what that meant is, you know, those are less severe injuries that have minor scrapes and, you know, burns from being hit by the car. But just going through the doors alone, $6,400, just getting on the ambulance is about $1,200. And if you're admitted to the hospital, meaning if you're actually there for more than a 24-hour period, the average cost jumps up to $75,000. So it's a very costly thing, and it's getting charged to public funds.
And then I imagine there are all the indirect costs, right? Meaning the productivity that's lost, the ongoing disability, so on and so forth, the loss to families, the emotional pain,
right,
and such.
Correct. The depression, the post-traumatic stress disorder, the changes in family structure because a father has passed away or, you know. And that's actually a study that we're looking at doing in the next
year. So you don't actually have a number there
yet? We don't have a number for that yet. And actually, so one of the things that we're finding is that over, you know, if we look at nationally, if we look at the studies on costs, when we look at injuries, there really aren't that many studies that are recent in terms of injury cost. And so the CDC is working really hard at this point to begin to do those. And so we're hoping that more data will be available in the near future.
Hmm. And when you compare us to the next most dangerous city for pedestrians, first of all, which city is that if you happen to know that information?
I think Rajiv Bhatia would probably be able to answer that question better than I would.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just to round out some questions for you, what do you see as the most common injuries out there, and what's the proportion of injuries versus fatalities, if you had a breakdown there?
Right. Injury, yeah. So we get about, I would say, about 13 to 19 deaths per year, depending on the year. And the injuries are obviously, you know, much more. So within a year, you'll get about 800.
Mm.
So it's definitely, you know, in terms of once you get hit by a car, your likelihood of dying is actually, you know, small, but it's not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But the injuries are the ones that are, you know, really severe, and they have the long-term repercussions that you're talking about.
And I don't know, again, if you have this information to share, but amongst those 800 injuries, mm-hmm. How many of those are lead to lifelong disability versus those that people kind of get back on their feet over a few weeks, months, or
right.
years even?
So what I can tell you is from our sample, about 50% of the people that come to the hospital actually go home,
mm-hmm.
and the other 50% are transferred to long-term care facilities, to skilled nursing facilities, other places where they require even longer-term care. So, I mean, 50%, that's a lot. If you compare it, we've also run studies on bicycle injuries. If you compare it to the bicyclists that get injured, because they tend to be younger and more resilient and healthier, 80% of those end up going home. So it is definitely it requires more long-term care to treat a pedestrian than to treat a cyclist that's been injured.
And that was Diana Lopez, Prevention Director with the San Francisco Injury Center at UCSF. And I want to bring in Dr. Rajiv Bhatia with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. He's the Director of Environmental Health Section there. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
So Diana mentioned that you might be the person who would help us understand how we compare to other cities in the country.
Well, I actually don't think that that's the right question. I think that the way we look at it at the health department, you know, the way we have been designing streets in every city in this country has not been good for pedestrian safety. And I think when we look at, you know, for about 50 years, the goals of the transportation system have been to move cars to move them at high speeds. And what that produced was a transportation system with lots of lanes, wide lanes, straight roads, intersections, again, for moving cars quickly. These were all good for cars moving, but they were really bad for pedestrians. These are all of the factors that make it more dangerous for pedestrians. And I guess I don't want to single out one city, because almost every urban area has a street design system that's very much like San Francisco. In fact, the guidelines and standards for transportation, road building and design are fairly uniform countrywide. Why we observe such a high burden of injuries and a high burden of fatalities is that in a system that's not designed for pedestrian safety, like every other city, we have a lot of people walking. And we have a lot of elderly, very vulnerable people walking. And I think that's one of the reasons we have high rates of fatalities. We know this not only because, these factors. We know this because in countries where they've actually tried to change the design of the roads to make it more friendly and safe for walking, they've seen dramatic declines in pedestrian injuries and fatalities, and they've developed incredible toolboxes and ways to manage this as a transportation design problem. And the how quickly they've been able to change things is really a testament to how fixable this is. I think there's another point here. While San Francisco may not be inherently more dangerous than another city like Los Angeles or New York or Philadelphia, some areas of San Francisco are remarkably more dangerous than others. We see the injuries highly concentrated in certain areas of the city.
Where are we talking?
We're talking 50% of the injuries happen in 8% of the land area. We see certain neighborhoods, about 20% of the neighborhoods responsible for about half of these injuries. These are predictably neighborhoods where there's a lot of people, either business districts or high-density residential areas, and at the same time, these neighborhoods have wide, multi-lane streets carrying a lot of traffic. The arterials taking traffic from the avenues to downtown. So you see the injuries concentrated generally in the northeast downtown area, in the Mission and the South of Market area, along corridors like Mission, along Geary, where there are, again, is a lot of people in wide streets.
And does this often overlap with poorer neighborhoods or more economically disenfranchised neighborhoods?
You know, I think it's a widely recognized point that higher density neighborhoods generally are lower income neighborhoods. And so, yes, I mean, there is a disparity by income. I think the other way, the other reason that low income people bear the burden of pedestrian injuries is only partly neighborhoods. Low-income people are the most likely ones to be exhibiting sort of sustainable transportation behavior, not owning cars and using the public transportation system.
So they happen to walk more.
These are the walkers. They don't have the steel frame four-wheel vehicles around them when they're on the street.
And as you think about this from a public health perspective, what kinds of things do you bring to the table when sitting with the other folks that we've talked about here and many other agencies that are not represented on this program?
Well, I think first we bring data. I think Diana pointed out that there is undercounting of the injuries in the city, and we're looking for more complete surveillance. We bring an analysis of the problems to try to identify what are the areas with the highest concentration and what are the factors, the environmental factors and behavioral factors in those areas that may be contributing. I think we bring an environmental perspective. I mean, I've worked in environmental health for over a decade. There's been historically, I think, and if you look at maybe a media report and how people comment on it, it always seems that either the pedestrians being blamed for being silly or stupid or some, you know, even downright suicidal, and or the drivers being blamed for being, you know, sort of obnoxious or crazy or
distracted by texting.
And part of it, you know, certainly everybody has a responsibility to follow the rules, but you know, at an environmental level, it's really how the system is designed. We should design a system that anticipates that people will make mistakes, that people will be distracted. I don't think we can easily, given all of the new distractions we have in society, I don't think we're going to win the war against distraction. I think we're going to have to design a system that means that you know, people get distracted, make mistakes, and won't die. And I think that's a very possible system. And it doesn't mean that we don't raise attention to the consequences of distraction, but there's no way we're going to be able to guarantee that kind of safe behavior.
And that was Dr. Rajiv Bhatia, Director of Environmental Health with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And I want to bring it back into the studio now with Elizabeth Stamp, Executive Director of Walk SF, a member-based pedestrian advocacy organization. So, Elizabeth, when you take it from the pedestrian's perspective, not from the, you know, the public health perspective, what kinds of things do the members of your organization say are priorities for them, and what kinds of messages are you finding either most effective or the hardest for people to hear?
I think the story about who's to blame comes up a lot. But what I really hear from people is that basically when you start talking to people, everyone is a pedestrian. At some point of the day, even if you're just walking to your car parked in a garage, you are walking and you are potentially at risk on the streets, or you're potentially enjoying getting to walk in San Francisco. And so everybody has a very personal relationship to walking, especially here in San Francisco. I think one of the big things that resonates for a lot of people is this issue around arterial streets, like 6th Street, like Masonic, where somebody was killed in a terrible crash quite recently, along Cesar Chavez, along 19th Avenue. These are all streets that are wide and fast, and especially in Soma, south of Market, and in the Tenderloin, cars are traveling fast. Maybe they're getting to or from the freeway, and those are very dangerous conditions. We especially hear from a lot of seniors who live in Soma that there are a lot of senior housing developments in that neighborhood, and they come right out of their front door and want to get across the street to run an errand or really to do anything, and they're confronting a 4 or a 6-lane street, potentially with traffic all going one direction, all going fast. The kind of design cues that Dr. Bhatia was talking about really tell the drivers, it's okay, you're on a freeway, you can just put the pedal down and go. And that is a really unsafe situation for an older person who's trying to cross, may not be able to move very quickly or see as well as he or she once did. And so we hear from a lot of folks that, especially in Soma and Tenderloin, but really throughout the city, it's not appropriate to have these sort of highway-style streets running through their neighborhoods.
And when you're up against other people, other stakeholders in this that perhaps may be affected by changes to our streetscape that would make pedestrian activity safer, what kind of counter-arguments are you up against? Let's say when we're talking about things that are going to affect the way motorists get to move around in the city. What are you hearing as pushback, if any?
Well, I think one thing that I've really seen happening is that there's a lot of pushback on some of the trials that have occurred. You know, at first, Sunday Streets, which Walk San Francisco helped to start. It's every Sunday, every month through the summer and through much of the year in San Francisco, the streets in a certain area are opened up to pedestrians and bikes, and cars aren't allowed, and it's kind of just a big, long street party. And at first, what Sunday Streets, what Walk SF, what the other organization that does it, Livable City, and the Bike Coalition all heard was that merchants were afraid that there wouldn't be, this would be bad for business. Now what's happening after this has been going for a few years is that different neighborhoods, different merchants are actually clamoring to have this come to their streets because it's been great for business. It's been great for the neighborhood. We also see it on Valencia Street, where I think merchants especially, but a lot of folks were very concerned about the traffic calming that was planned for there. And, you know, certainly the construction is no fun to live through. I live just off Valencia myself and heard a lot of the construction. But now that it's changed, now that the traffic is calmer, there's been what's called a road diet. There's actually a bike lane. There are better crosswalks and the sidewalks are wider. And actually, all of the traffic is timed to go at 13 miles an hour. If you're going at 13 miles an hour, which is bike speed or potentially car speed, you get a green light all the way. So what's interesting is a lot of people who were opposed to this at first, the merchants, love it. They get so much more foot traffic because it's a much more attractive place to walk. And then also, it's safer for pedestrians. Cyclists, of course, like it. And what we're hearing, too, is that people actually like to drive along Valencia because the frustration in city driving comes from having to stop and go. So if you're actually progressing smoothly, even if it's at a slower, safer speed, the experience for drivers is fine as well. So people are really actually enjoying a lot of the improvements that they thought at first maybe they wouldn't.
So people actually coming around. And I want to take a moment to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're discussing pedestrian safety in San Francisco with our guest, Diana Lopez, Prevention Director with the San Francisco Injury Center at UCSF, Elizabeth Stamp, Executive Director of Walk SF, a member-based pedestrian advocacy organization. And by phone, we're joined by Dr. Rajiv Bhatia, Director of Environmental Health with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. In just a moment, we're going to be hearing from Timothy Papandreou with the San Francisco Municipal Transit Authority. And we invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, where you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Timothy Papandreou, thank you for waiting so patiently on the line.
No problem.
So in many ways, I feel like you're the man with all the potential solutions here. So tell us, synthesize for us all the things that you've heard so far this evening. How do you take that information and those points of view into your planning when you work with your colleagues and the others that join you as you move forward to try to define and design and implement more livable and, in this case, safer streets?
Yeah, thank you. I think the three speakers have really put it into perspective, and I think we all agree on the same points. And I think the key for us has been, you know, I think Dr. Bhatia said it really well, like, you know, 50, 60 years ago, the streets were designed to move cars and to move a lot of cars. And now the objective has changed, where in the 70s we had the Transit First policy enacted, which really, really was a mind shift for the city and, in fact, the nation to look at how do we promote more transit and put transit first. And then since then we changed our parking standards and really focused on increasing office and residential density and developing this concept called transit-oriented developments and mixed-use neighborhoods, et cetera. So there's been like this evolution over the last two or three decades. And with that has come funding for making streets more multimodal, which means, you know, the whole complete streets movement that came out a decade or ago. And so a lot of these policies have been enacted and funding's been directed in many ways. And the area of pedestrian safety, I think, is the area that really has no overall vision or mission, but it's affected by everything that we do. And I think Elizabeth really said it when we said everybody's a pedestrian, not everybody's a bicyclist, although we want them to be, not everybody's a transit rider, not everybody drives a car, but whether you're in a wheelchair or able walking, you are always a pedestrian, whether it's at the beginning or the end of your trip. And that really goes into all of our projects that we do, and I feel like, you know, we've inherited this street system which pre-car was very walkable and very transit-oriented, and then we motorized it, and now we're trying to retrofit it and make it into a complete street network. And that comes with a lot of costs. There's a lot of money that's involved to redo streets, and the project that that Elizabeth was talking about, you know, Valencia Street, that six-block segment, you know, was in the multiple millions of dollars per block to fix these. So there's a lot of costs that we can incur to retrofit projects and streets. And there's another way that we can do it, in that we can actually make sure that in our design guidelines that we inherently design for safer streets that are more pedestrian-oriented, more bicycle-oriented, more transit-oriented, et cetera, et cetera. Also, with our land use development, as we're seeing more growth in San Francisco, we're really trying to tie the land use to the complete walkable street framework, so that development that goes in actually pays for streetscape upgrades, changes the street circulation, et cetera. And so there's a million reasons why the streets are not working right now for pedestrians, and there's maybe a dozen or so good solutions that we're trying them in different ways. And one of our key issues is, how do we get the right set of design guidelines? How do we get the funding in place so we can actually deliver these projects on the ground as quickly as possible and really meet those objectives of making a more complete community, which is not just the transit and development and the streets, but an overall complete community where this is a short, small city. You should be able to walk pretty much everywhere, anywhere, all the time, and whatever we can do to make that happen.
Except for the hills, of course.
What's that?
Except for the hills, of course. But I wanted to ask you, if there was one design element, now, of course, not all streets, you know, have the same design flaws that are not pedestrian friendly. If there's one design element that would be sort of the biggest bang for your buck, which one would it be?
I think right now what we've been looking at is physical on-street changes that narrow the street down physically and in permanent ways.
This is the road diet idea.
Well, I'm getting to something before I get to the answer. Those sort of things are really, really beneficial. Designing the street down, slowing the street down by design, so you physically can't go fast, which means you physically cannot injure someone severely, is really, really one of the best things that we can do. It comes with a pretty hefty price tag. What we can do, though, in the meantime, is
could you give us an idea of, like, for one block to do this, to one block, how much does it cost?
It can cost anywhere between $500,000 and $10 million. It just depends on
what
you're
doing.
So if you're moving streets, if you're moving drainage basins, if you're widening sidewalks, et cetera, these things it just depends on what it is. They can get very expensive. And not to say that we shouldn't do it, but it's something that's a more of a longer term process. Things that we can do quickly and quite cost effectively and monitor them are changing speed limits, changing signal timing so that, you know, the lights change so you can't go really fast. Looking at pilots that we can do, temporary trials where we can, rather than doing the permanent structure, we can trial something by putting in temporary barriers or temporary pieces of infrastructure in the ground that gives a geometric design that slows things down, and then we can test it and see how well it works, and then we can refine it for when we go for permanent funding. That's really the things that you can do right now. You know, everybody wants to see everything in the ground now, and so do we, and, you know, we're working as hard as we can to do it. It's just there's literally a time lag and a funding lag that comes with that.
If I remember my physics correctly, there's speed and then there's momentum, right?
Correct.
And if you decrease the speed even by a little bit, the actual gain you get in the decrease in the impact is quite amazing.
It's phenomenal. I mean, you know, and I think Dr. Padilla and Diana knows really well, and Elizabeth, everybody knows, well, these guys know it really well. You know, if you just slow down the speed by just a few miles an hour, your chances of surviving an impact increase exponentially, and so it's a real issue that we need to really focus on. And, you know, we are going to put in where we're looking at reducing the speed of the arterial roads. We're looking at putting in all these different elements we can, but I think the bigger question is, you know, what are the role of these streets? How do we actually make these streets more walkable, more inviting to be more bicycle and transit oriented, at the same time providing consistency and predictability and not making it, you know, impossible to get around. So there's always that trade-off that we have to work with.
Okay, we have several callers waiting patiently on the line, a couple of emails to get to, but I want to, again, reintroduce our program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing pedestrian safety in San Francisco with Diana Lopez of the San Francisco Injury Center at UCSF, Elizabeth Stamp, Executive Director of Walk SF, Dr. Rajiv Bhatia of the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and Timothy Papandreou of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. 415-841-4134, the number to call to join our conversation, 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So let's go to our first caller. That's going to be John from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having this program on pedestrian safety in San Francisco. I call you and pose a question to the four speakers, whom I all know, to please address the pedestrian signals that represent safety or a means for a pedestrian to know how safe it is for them to get across the street, when a higher percentage, it is growing, of residents and visitors in San Francisco are senior citizens, when the pedestrian signals were established over 36 years ago based on an 18-year-old college student on how fast they could walk across the street, when there is now, according to Kevin Sagan, a journalist of San Francisco Chronicle, a silver tsunami of senior citizens living here, according to the 2010 census data. How will that be adjusted in the pedestrian signals to reflect it takes seniors a little bit longer than it was designed for an 18-year-old college student to walk across?
Timothy, did you want to answer that?
We have we've been looking at the signal timing and the rate per second, the crossing distance per second, and ours are actually more generous than the national standard, but at the end of the day, we need to reduce the crossing distance to make sure that there are other infrastructure in the street as well, pedestrian refuge islands, anything else that can reduce the crossing distance. We're going to be focusing and looking at that as one of our best tools to meet that. But John's right, as the population gets older and is walking slower, it's going to create a need to readjust all the signals for pedestrians.
Okay. And Rajiv, did you want to add to that?
No, I think Tim is pointing out the issue of the reducing the crossing distance, and there's several techniques for that, the bulb outs or the islands in the center of the street. I think those are very important. But again, it's all, I think that, you know, I think what you're hearing is that there's a consensus that we have to redesign the streets for needs that we haven't been taking into account for a while, and that's going to take some time. I think there's a one of the strategies that we didn't hear about is the strategies of enforcement and compliance. Even without changing anything else, if people observe the current speed limits, we'd save a lot of lives. We've calculated that if people observe the speed limits, that we might save up to half of the fatalities that we observe. And there's many things that can be done more immediately to achieve that. Some of the things require changes in state law, like camera-based enforcement. But we could start a conversation in San Francisco and, you know, have a media campaign to help people understand why, you know, driving a few miles faster may make your life a little bit more convenient, but it actually could create quite a bit of risks. And I think many people in San Francisco might, through that kind of collective conversation, adjust their behavior.
And Diana, do you have some statistics for us about the impact of this issue on the elderly or an elderly person being hit?
Sure.
What does it mean for them?
Yeah, so if we're looking at the likelihood to die, actually, the Department of Public Health recently calculated something, and it looks like it's about 6 times the likelihood of dying for a person who's elderly versus someone who's in another age range. And so I think that's a reason why it's really important to plan a lot of these changes in infrastructure close to places like senior centers or in areas where you're going to have naturally a higher number of elderly individuals either living or, you know, participating in leisurely activities in those areas.
And Elizabeth, do you want to add to that?
I just think that it's worth emphasizing that, for example, south of Market, there are so many senior housing developments and there's so many wide, fast arterial streets that connect to the freeway. So that's really a priority to tackle, because this year, actually, 3 out of, I believe it's 4 people who so far have been killed have been seniors.
415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go next to Steve. Welcome to the program.
Great. Hi there. Great program. It's important, I think, for people to understand that, and this is a good news peg, actually, because they just dropped the speed limit on Folsom and on Harrison Streets today. And this is important. I walk to and from work. I live downtown or work downtown and live over by the Bay Bridge, by the ballpark, and walk by the transit terminal. And it's a mess there with buses turning and cars turning. And both the people that drive and pedestrians have to be careful. On almost a daily basis, I get hit by people trying to do a right turn on red. What should we do as pedestrians when we're almost being hit by a car? My father was out here vacationing and kicked the car. He just turned and kicked it, and he tore one guy's mirror off. Now, I don't advocate that for anybody, because the person in the car could come out and scream at you, or worse. But
or worse.
What type of action should we take? And then also, for the people to address that pedestrians, I see a lot of people on their iPods all the time, or cell phones and texting while walking too. So,
okay, thanks so much, Steve, for your comments. So I want to break down those two questions. So the first question is, what should a pedestrian do if they're almost hit, to kind of either take it out on the motorist or to document the situation? Let's start with that question first. Elizabeth, any thoughts?
I think it would be a good idea to call the police to let them know that there's an issue with drivers acting in a dangerous way in a certain area. What we've heard from the police is that they're actually very responsive to folks calling in with issues. It might be worth getting the license plate of the car as well. And it might also be worth calling calling your city supervisor and letting them know that this area is potentially a dangerous one. If you think that that's not the only time that this sort of thing has occurred in that spot, it's worth letting the city decision makers know.
And then to the staying with you with the second question, which is what to do in terms of I blanked on Steve's second question, but it'll come back to me. So let's go to our next caller. Welcome to the program.
Would that be me?
I believe it's you.
All right.
Yes. Thank you so much, Marie Louise from Palo Alto. I had a senior moment there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So I think we need some humane, very good messages to be posted here and there. And I know there's ways to do this. But, for example, I was thinking trying to get there fast can sometimes take a very long time, plus cost a life. Just sort of, you know, sayings that we can send to people a lot, and I think we need to post these kinds of things around San Francisco. Also, from what I see when I'm there, is that it looks very precarious many times around Union Square, Market Street, around that area. Loads of people trying to get across the street, and then cars again making a right turn on a red light, and a previous caller mentioned that also, and I think it for San Francisco, it seems maybe it would be good to just have a law, no right turn on red ever within the city limits, because it seems so dangerous. So I guess that's what I have to say.
Thanks so much, Marie Louise. And Timothy, I actually had that thought this morning as I was driving to work and thinking about the right on red. And when you're in that sort of zone, feeling like you're just kind of just moving along, you know, cities like New York City just basically ban the right on red. And it's one of the few cities that I know of that does it. And I know there's certain intersections here in this city where that's the case. But what would it be like, do you imagine, if the San Francisco tried to propose banning right on red here? Do you think it would cause a revolt, or is banning right on red on most sort of hotspot intersections, would that be considered another cost-effective intervention?
Yeah, I mean, that would be part of the list of cost-effective interventions, and, you know, we'd have to take it to our policymakers to adopt it citywide. I think the issue would come down to enforcement. You know, it's one thing to have signs and things up everywhere, but if we're not enforcing them, then it gives people mixed messages. And so one way to do that is to, I think the call is right on. We need to have more education outreach campaigns. We've partnered a few times with the Department of Public Health on some pedestrian safety messaging that we put up throughout the city. Sustaining that, again, you know, I keep talking about the funding issue. We just need to sustain that. We need to have a lot more access to resources that are really hard to come by, especially for these kind of things.
Again, you're listening to City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing pedestrian safety with our guest Diana Lopez of the San Francisco Injury Center, Elizabeth Stamp of Walk SF, Timothy Papandreou of the SFMTA, and Dr. Rajiv Bhatia of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 to join our conversation, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And Elizabeth, I remembered Steve's other question, which is this idea of pedestrian responsibility, the texting pedestrian, the iPodding pedestrian, the otherwise distracted pedestrian, the jaywalking pedestrian. I understand this issue of not blaming one side or the other more, but when we're talking about behavior change, how do we get at some of those pieces in trying to solve this issue?
Well, I think it's important to remember kind of the relative levels of responsibility that folks have, whether you're walking or you're biking or you're driving. You know, San Francisco is a dense city. We're all sharing the streets. This is shared space, and we need to watch out for each other. I think, you know, a person who's driving and texting poses a much, much greater threat. If you think about somebody who's operating a vehicle that weighs 3,000 or many more pounds than that versus somebody who's 150 pounds, the kind of force that somebody is responsible for when they're driving and when they're texting, that's a much greater responsibility because they can cause much greater harm. Of course, people shouldn't text while they're crossing the street. Of course, they should watch out. The idea of listening to an iPod while walking, you know, people do that. That's a pretty reasonable thing to do. People listen to music in the car, and they have a higher level of responsibility there. So I think we just all need to watch out for each other and also need to recognize that occasionally we're going to be distracted. And going back to designing our streets in a way that's safe, that's really one thing that we can do to, over the long term, make sure that we have a safer city for everyone. Because there are a lot of folks who aren't going to be watching out. You know, little kids just don't have the same cognitive capacity that adults do. And any parent of a little kid knows that it is really, really scary, because you don't know if your kid's going to run out into the street. You don't know if drivers are going to see them. So if we can calm the traffic a little to make the conditions safer, that's really the goal.
And Rajiv, what's your take on this question of behavior modification of pedestrians?
Well, everyone has a responsibility to follow the safety rules. But I agree with Elizabeth that if you're driving a machine that can cause damage, you have a greater responsibility. And the bigger the machine, the more the responsibility is. But, you know, I think where this really needs to lead is to a city conversation about pedestrian safety and making this idea of a transit-first city real. I think we had this amazing vision in San Francisco, And I don't think we necessarily had the honest discussion about, you know, what the consequences were, that there would have to be trade-offs, that driving, you know, would have to be slower. I think in the where we need to kind of aim for is a city where, you know, perhaps the iPod listening pedestrian bumps into a car, but the car is not traveling so fast, and it's not such a hazard. I think in a busy city, a vibrant city, a lively city with people and cars, people are going to bump into each other, and that's going to happen occasionally, and there's no way to prevent that. We can make these, we can design the streets as shared streets in ways that the you know, nobody dies or gets seriously disabled.
I just thought of a possible slogan, more bump and less bruising. No one likes that one. That's okay. So let's go to Ed. Welcome to the program. Ed, welcome.
Hi, good evening. I'm a blind individual, and I wanted to give you a perspective from a blind person. It is rather difficult to know sometimes when to cross the street if the traffic is a bit lower than usual. And so having an audible pedestrian signal can be very useful. And there are ones now that can simply speak to you, and rather than, you know, doing the loud signals that one is familiar with. And so I think this might also help those who are distracted. Perhaps they can see, but by having the audible cue, that may assist them as well.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. Timothy, is that in the works, more audible cross signals?
Absolutely. We've been leading in the country in installing audible pedestrian signals, becoming accessible pedestrian signals as well, where they not only they give audible cues to when to cross the street, and we've been installing them as quickly as we can get the funding to lay them out there.
And Dr. Bhatia, I want to go back to you for just a moment, because you didn't laugh at my joke. No, just kidding. Because I want to ask about this issue of enforcement. You brought it up a couple of times, actually. So enforcement of traffic laws. And what are some of the hindrances to doing more of that? Because I imagine people are also motivated by, you know, negative consequences.
Well, people definitely are motivated by negative consequences. And, you know, if we had... I mean, it's totally unrealistic. I mean, if we had the level of police resources and the lack of other police problems to deal with, and the police could you know, monitor this and ticket people, and I think the problem would go away. But we don't have those resources, and it's not necessary. I mean, we have other public safety problems that are competing. Definitely, there needs to be more enforcement and. I think people who drive need to know that we take the driver safety law seriously. It's not clear that that's the feeling today out there in the street. Mm. But there are simpler ways to do it, and definitely a lot more cost-effective ways to get people to be aware of the streets. Radar speed signs that tell you your speed and indicate to you when you're slowing down create a feedback mechanism that has been proven to work to slow people down, and that doesn't require an armed police officer on the street with checking your speed and giving tickets. Europe and other countries have used automated speed enforcement. These are the radars with cameras attached, much like the red light cameras. They're incredibly effective at reducing speeding, 70% or 80% and reductions in speeding and long-lasting effects. So,
and why aren't those being implemented?
Well, we have again. It's been I think part of the culture. They've been experimented with in many places in the United States, not in San Francisco. And they've not gone forward for a couple of reasons. In some places, I think a notable example is Arizona. They were installed on freeways. They were incredibly successful in saving lives. But then the legislature said, "Nope, they're illegal now."
Like invasion of privacy. What's the issue?
Privacy, right?
Okay.
Privacy, and people criticize them as money making or tools or tax making, you know, tax tools for government when they're really safety tools. The other thing, the thing that's kind of slowing them down in California right now is that we don't have clear rules of evidence and clear enabling legislation at the state level to say that the kind of evidence that an automated speed, sort of a radar and photo enforcement would produce is adequate for the enforcement, for giving a ticket. And I think some laws would have to be clarified in order to do that. There's no law banning these speed cameras, but San Jose tried this, and they stopped their program because they were just a little, they were getting pushback, and they were a little unsure whether they had the legal standing to use it under current California law.
Okay, let's go to some more callers. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. SFMTA is trying to shove through a program that will definitely have blood on the hands of both bicyclists, cars, and pedestrians at the corner of Market, Goff, and Haight by directing buses down the last two blocks of Haight Street. They've presented this plan, they've assumed funding for it, and they've brought no good plans forth. This is where two major bike intersections come through. This is where pedestrians from Hayes Valley goes into Haight Street. And they are hell-bent on getting this through. What does Walk San Francisco have to say about this, and why is this program going through?
Okay, thanks very much, David, for your call. And this exact question came up 2 weeks ago when we did our show on the bike plan. I'm not sure if it was David who posed this exact question. But first I want to go to Timothy to respond, and then we'll get Elizabeth as well. So, Timothy.
So, if I understand the question is, why are we doing two-way Haight?
Right.
Okay, I think in the previous iteration of this area, when the roads were reconfigured to basically move vehicles around, when the freeways came down after the earthquake, there was all these changes that were made to this whole street system. But prior to that, we had the current transit lines run one way because the streets are one way. And there's been a vision for a long time. It's a long time vision to have two-way Haight continue all the way into Market Street for transit circulation, for pedestrian improvements, and to also help with community economic revitalization as well. The project that we've been securing funding for is to make that segment two-way and to realign the transit system so that people can go east and west east and west on one side of the street.
Okay. Elizabeth, your thoughts?
Yeah, Walk San Francisco actually supports a two-way Haight, like making many other streets two-way around the city, Ellis, Eddy, Folsom. This is a way to calm traffic and reclaim the transit priority that the city is supposed to have. Right now, the bus has to make kind of a long, a long detour to get where it needs to go. And by just fixing this one block of Haight Street, that'll actually give transit back the priority, and there will be pedestrian improvements.
And let's go to Casey in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. I walk 1 to 2 hours daily in the city. I've been doing it for years.
Good for you.
As I walk, I do so with my head on a swivel. I walk fast, and I look very thoroughly left and right. And the most important thing I need to know is which way cars and trucks will go when I come to an intersection. There's a safety device for that purpose, which San Franciscans seem loath to use these days. It doesn't even cost anything because it's already installed in every car and truck. It's called a turn signal or blinker, and it gives vital information to us pedestrians about which way heavy, multi-ton rolling machines, which vehicles are, will move. And for some reason, the police ignore this law. Where is the police enforcement of this unsafe driving practice? The streets will never get safer until drivers drive better and police enforce driving behavior. This needs to happen daily to change driver behavior, habits. A half dozen stings a year that the police do won't work. So I'd call on a new police chief, sir, to take this opportunity to turn San Francisco into a city that cares about pedestrian safety. I'm not a car hater. I drive as well as walk, and using a blinker is so simple, one doesn't have to look to use it. So let's have our very active SF supervisors work with the police department and announce a renewed effort, cite Goff laws, and encourage more pedestrian-aware driving. Enforcement.
Okay, Casey, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off there. Thank you. Tony, welcome to the program. Tony?
I'm here.
Okay. Keep your comment brief, please, because we're running on the end of the program here.
basically, we were taught from kindergarten, when I went to kindergarten, that you look both ways. And I found that by looking both ways, it's improved my driving. I've avoided accidents driving. And I notice a lot of people in San Francisco just don't do that. And it just amazes me that people would walk out in the street and not have a concern about their own life. And that was a simple thing that should be taught, you know, when you're a child.
So you're saying pedestrians should look both ways as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're the ones who are going to be hurt. And,
right. And Thanks for your call, Tony. And we go. Let me go to an email here from Jack in the Sunset. He says, I try to cross Lincoln Boulevard in the Sunset at 10th Avenue daily. I have to develop the psyche of a matador as the drivers actually speed up to make me, quote unquote, get back, as they think that it is not a crosswalk since it is not a marked crosswalk. The SFPD refuses to make a point out of this anywhere. The DMV handbook says that the pedestrian rights are the same in either case, and no one knows this. So we actually have last few minutes here in the program. So I wanted to get a couple of points here. Elizabeth, any particular things that you want to tell pedestrians to do and how to get involved in your efforts?
Yeah, I think that was a great point that the person wrote in by email about. And Walk San Francisco, as you mentioned, is a member-based organization. We're at walksf.org. We hope folks will go to our website and join. We're working on getting a pedestrian action plan for real commitments from the city to pedestrian safety. We're working on safe speed zones around schools, 15-mile-an-hour zones around more than 200 schools around the city, working with MTA on this. It's very exciting. And also accountable strategic enforcement so that the police are actually going out and ticketing where the most and the worst crashes occur. That's what we're working on, so we hope folks will join us.
Great. Diana, very briefly, what kind of data is coming out of the SF Injury Center to come in the next few months or years?
Sure, we're going to be looking at long-term quality of life studies. And we actually just conducted, a cost-benefit analysis looking at some of the engineering countermeasures and how they compare to some of our costs.
And Dr. Bhatia, quickly, what kinds of things is the Department of Public Health putting forth next in trying to get at this issue?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
What kinds of things are the Department of Public Health trying to do to get at this issue? What are your next steps?
Our next steps are, to continue to clearly define the environmental causes and the best practices around the world. We've observed that this is a very solvable problem, and other countries have solved it. And I think San Franciscans will very reasonably eventually choose safety over convenience. So we're excited about being part of that.
And Timothy, as you start to roll out some of your streetscape reengineering plans, how can the public on both sides or all sides of this issue get involved in the conversation, and how can they keep track of what's going on a street near them?
Sure. We are leading a pedestrian safety task force right now to really get to those best practices that everybody's talking about and get those designs on the ground. We have multiple projects that are on right now. There is the Cesar Chavez redesign project, Market Street redesign project, the Haight two-way redesign project. The list goes on and on for me to mention right now, but the best way for them to get involved is, as Elizabeth said, either contact their supervisor or just go straight to sfmta.com and look at the projects there. You can search under our sustainable streets, livable streets category. There's traffic calming projects, different things that we're doing that are pedestrian countdown signals being installed, opening up closed crosswalks, putting in more crosswalks.
Sounds like you're doing a lot, and we're going to have to stop it there. Oh. Okay, and that's City Visions for this evening. Before we go, I just want to thank all of our listeners who showed your support during KLW's recent spring membership drive. It's listeners like you that keep this station going and inspire us to come in and week out to bring you the best that public radio has to offer. Thank you once again for your support for this station. And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Diana Lopez, Prevention Director with the San Francisco Injury Center at UCSF, Elizabeth Stamp, Executive Director of WalkSF, Timothy Papandreou, Deputy Director of the SFMTA Sustainable Streets Long-Range Planning and Policy Division, Dr. Rajiv Bhatia, Director of Environmental Health with SFDPH. Thank you all for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to tell us what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by our senior producer, Judith Sansone, with help from producer Shashi Patel. And Neil Freese manages our website. We'll be away next Monday for Memorial Day. Join me June 6th when we'll look at public employee pension reform. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.